will be at the Rockwood Music Hall, stage 3 at 10. Sons of an Illustrious Father will be at the Mercury Lounge, Manhattan, 10:30. On your concert billboard for Tuesday, November 25th, Funk Philharmonic will be at KJ Farrell's in Belmore, 7 p.m. Dave Davies will be at City Winery, Manhattan, at 8. Robert Randolph and the Family Band will be at the Brooklyn Bowl, beginning at 8. Looking ahead to Wednesday, November 26th, Lila McCalla will be at Subculture, Manhattan, 8 p.m.
If you hear some musician on WUSB, you'll hear where they're playing locally on Concert Billboard. Arenas, bars, coffee houses, or outdoor festivals. They're all here at WUSB.FM/CBB and 90.1 FM WUSB Stony Brook, New York.
And this is WUSB Stony Brook, 1 minute after 6 o'clock, time once again for Off the Wall. Very good evening, everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Manuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. An abbreviated show tonight. Very unfortunate because we have so much to talk about, obviously, with what's been going on. And, wow, where do you begin? It's not like any of us were really surprised, is it? Is anyone out there truly surprised by the reaction? I'm surprised by how it played out. The absolutely insanely stupid way that this was done from start to finish, from the very unfortunate incident that started all this in Ferguson to the way that this miscarriage of justice was finally announced. It has been one clumsy maneuver after another. It's as if they've learned nothing in our entire history. Nothing about police work, race relations, crowd control, justice, none of that. It's like they're learning it for the first time. So no, I wasn't at all surprised to see the city go up in flames. I expected that. I think everybody expected that. And I am so fed up hearing people talk in this patronizing tone about how, well, you're getting nothing from that. You're not advancing your cause. You're only hurting yourselves. Apparently, these are people who have never been completely frustrated before. And I guess that's understandable, because it is impossible, absolutely impossible, for anyone from the most left-wing liberal imaginable to the furthest to the right Klan member you can think of, it is impossible for anyone in white skin to imagine what it is like to be otherwise. And that's just a fact. That's just a fact. There is no way you can conceive of what day-to-day life. You can sympathize. You can try and do as much as you can to be fair, open-minded, just. But you'll never actually know what it's like. And if you have that knowledge, at least you won't wind up saying stupid things. Well, not incredibly stupid things. You know what? Let's get this over with, because we have so much else to talk about. And as you know, we introduced a new feature last week. Yeah, I called it Moron of the Week last week, but I realize a better name for it is Dumbass of the Week. And I guess I'm the Dumbass of the Week for not turning down the other theme. Okay, there we go. This basically is an award that we give out once a week to somebody who says something particularly stupid, moronic, or just being an overall dumbass. And this week, the award for Dumbass of the Week goes to former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. Did you see him? Did you see this guy on the Sunday afternoon talk show, Sunday morning talk show? What was it, Face the Nation or something? He was basically saying how he made life so much better when he was mayor of New York. Yeah, he saved the city, he saved race relations, he saved all that stuff. He also faced a good amount of web backlash right after he said all that. Each one with such gems as 93% of blacks are killed by other blacks. I would like to see the attention paid to that, that you are paying to this. This being the whole Ferguson incident that had not yet erupted in quite the stage that it did. The thing that statements like this tend to overlook is that people who are intent on killing other people, tend to kill people that are close to them. In other words, you're not likely to go out to a far and distant land and kill somebody. People do it, but it's not likely. You're likely to kill your neighbor or somebody that you bump into in a car or whatnot. So 84% of white murders are committed by white people. How about that? Doesn't mention that at all. No, it's only the black-on-black crime that's a problem. And his quote, I think the quote that really earned him the title this week, "White police officers wouldn't be there if you weren't killing each other." Oh, yeah. And he said this to the person he was talking to on Meet the Press, Michael Eric Dyson, who was basically a consultant for MSNBC and was kind of presenting the other side, the side of sanity. But if you weren't killing each other, because he happened to be black, he was part of all this mayhem of black people killing other black people, and it takes the white man to walk in there and say, "Hey, I'm going to fix all this and take care of you because you can't take care of yourselves." Yeah, that's a kind of nonsense that that we have to deal with. He gave some figures too, which I just wanted to kind of examine a little bit. He said something about how the murder rate in New York City went way down. And it has gone down. It's gone down almost every year and for the last 20 or so years. It's gone up a few times, but it's basically been on a steady downward decline. Now, is the mayor responsible for this? Is the police commissioner responsible for this? Is the sanitation commissioner? Nobody knows who's responsible, but it's a trend. It's a trend. But his quote here on this program, where he got really bent out of shape, it's worth seeing. It really is, because he's very flustered. And you have to wonder why. Why is he so bent out of shape? "I'd probably save more black lives as mayor of New York than any mayor in the history of this city." Yeah, with the possible exception of Mike Bloomberg, who was there for 12 years. Well, actually, the rate went up a little bit with Mike Bloomberg. But here's what he said. He said, "Thousands of blacks were being killed every year when he came into office in 1994. Well, 1994, I looked this up, the murder rate in 1994 was just about 2016, in fact. So unless every single one of those was a black person, then it's not really thousands. So that's a bit of an exaggeration right there. And then the number dropped to about 200 by the time he left 8 years later. Well, okay, let's look at that number then. The total number of murders in 2001, your last year in office, was 960. So 200 of those were black people. So by your own numbers, you're saying that the remaining 760 were not. 200 plus 760 is 960. 200 black people, 760 other. And if you move those figures around, it's just, you're not making any sense. And you're being a racist pig at the same time. Dumbass of the week. All right. That's that. And, of course, if you have any suggestions for Dumbass of the Week, remember, I'm ineligible, and so are friends, family, and listeners, too, if you can't nominate yourself. But write to us, otw@2600.com. That's our email address. We love to hear from you. But, yeah, you know, this patronizing tone that you hear from so many people about the rioters. First of all, riots have taken place all throughout our history. Right, this country, in fact, was founded on a riot. Remember the Boston Tea Party? Hey, that's only going to hurt you. Dumping all the tea into the harbor like that, what are you thinking? Well, guess what? Sometimes you have to react when a situation is completely intolerable. And we see this happen time and time again. Yeah, oftentimes you wind up hurting the people close to you when you do something like this. You wind up hurting yourself. Unbridled emotion can do that. What you really have to look at, though, is what led us to this point. And that's what we keep seeing to miss. We can never seem to learn this. That injustice piled upon injustice over the years leads to this sense of frustration and hopelessness, and certainly makes things really, really difficult to change. You know, I get into many arguments, and oh my God, Thanksgiving is coming up. We're going to have a tough time this year. All these arguments I get into with right-wing people who say they can't understand why the blacks have all this trouble when all these other ethnic groups have been able to climb out and make something for themselves. But they don't seem to want to. Yeah, because they really don't want to. That's it. You got it. You just got to sometimes take apart what these people say. You basically are, and it's sort of what Giuliani was saying. You keep killing each other. You keep hurting each other. You keep not succeeding. Being shot by cops and stuff like that. What's wrong with you? Well, it goes a little deeper than that. Like I said before, you have absolutely no conception of what it is like to be in a situation like that, to grow up in black or brown skin in this country or in any country. But in this country, it definitely makes a difference. It makes a difference on who you hang out with, on where you go to school, on where you live, on what your opportunities are. So you can't just climb out. Theoretically, it's like one of those teams in the 10th division of the football leagues in England making it to the FA Cup final. We all know that's not going to happen. Theoretically, it's possible. Realistically, it's extremely difficult and very challenging. And the odds are stacked against it. And that's what we need to be looking at. Yeah, it's horrible when buildings are burning down. But you know what? It wasn't aware of anybody being killed or even seriously hurt. Of course, I did see the cops firing tear gas directly into crowds, including one time where a woman was unconscious. And I see this way too often. I see cops panicking. I've seen it in person, and I hear countless accounts of this throughout the media. Just over the past week, all right, let's take a look at what happened. You had this cop in Brooklyn entering a building, climbing a pitch-black stairwell in a Brooklyn housing project. And this rookie cop is going up the stairs, down the stairs, you know what, I'm not even sure. But he's got his gun drawn. And he's obviously scared. That's probably why he has his gun drawn. And so as soon as he sees or is aware of the other guy in the stairwell, remember, it's pitch dark, you can't really see, and somebody with dark skin looks particularly ominous to somebody with light skin. In fact, I think that's even in the Darren Wilson testimony. He looked like a demon. Hulk Hogan. I was a five-year-old. He was Hulk Hogan. Well, you know, five-year-olds shouldn't be cops. How about that? Back to Brooklyn, though. All this guy did was walk into a stairwell of a building he had every right to be in. And to their credit, the NYPD from the beginning said this guy was totally innocent. Even though the media saw fit to drag out his arrest record, as if that has anything to do with it. But yeah, he had a long criminal history. Even though he never served any time, he was arrested for, holding marijuana? Something that white people wouldn't get arrested for. Or loitering? Something white people wouldn't get arrested for. All these things that if you are black, you're used to. If you are white, you have no conception of. So, okay, yeah, you know what? Long list of things, of run-ins with the cops, but no history of violence, no history of imprisonment. Not that that would make a difference either. The guy was still innocent. But it makes us feel a little bit better when we say, oh, he was a criminal. Okay, no big deal. Poor cop. He needs counseling. Must have gone through hell. So, yeah, he kills this guy in the stairwell because he was scared. And this kind of thing happens over and over again. Now, unfortunately, you don't see as much of a reaction. I think the guy who the officer who killed him was Asian American. If he had been white, I think that probably would have been more of a reaction. That's unfortunate that this is what it takes. There was another documented case, video, of a black cop beating the crap out of a fare evader on a subway station. That's all over the place. Not getting much attention, not getting much outrage. And I have a feeling if the cop was white, it would be getting a lot more outrage. Now, it's understandable, because you add racial issues to the police issues, you have a really outrageous situation. And maybe if you just have the police issues without the race, it's not as outrageous, but I think it should be. Because it's an element of fear, it's oppression, it's got to stop. And then, of course, you have what happened in Cleveland. 12-year-old kid running around the playground with a toy gun. You know, I did things like this when I was a kid. Of course, I was white when I was a kid, but times were different. The proliferation of guns, this is yet another thing that the proliferation of guns has done to us. It's made us not be able to tell the difference between toys and real guns. You see a kid running around in the playground a bunch of years ago with a toy gun, it's pretty obvious the kid's not going to have a real gun. That doesn't happen. Well, now it does happen. Now kids do have real guns because our friends over at the NRA decided, hey, everyone should have a gun. It's great for us. It's what our founding fathers wanted. But no, it doesn't quite work out that way. They say, you know, if the orange thing in the gun, which tells you it's a toy, that wasn't there, so they had to assume it was real. Really, this is how we define things? Has there never been a criminal who has thought to paint an orange thing onto a real gun so that they wouldn't get shot because, oh, it's a toy. It's orange. This is what we're relying on. This is how we tell toys from the real thing. No, obviously, that's completely bogus. And I'll bet the kid didn't even know about this. So what happened? That somebody called this in. And you can see on the transcript, he said twice that this kid's got a gun. It's probably fake. It's probably a toy, but he's annoying people. He's scaring people. But I don't think that was transmitted to the cops, that particular bit of information, that vital bit of information. If it was, then they are 100% culpable, as opposed to only, say, 70%. But when they arrived, they basically, this is what really bugs me, because this is how it's reported in the media. They issued commands, and the 12-year-old did not follow them. Commands? We're not in the damn army. You know, you're not our drill sergeant. You don't issue commands to civilians. No, sorry. We don't follow orders. That doesn't mean that if a cop tells you to do something, you should do the opposite. But it's that attitude that I'm objecting to. Issuing commands. No, that's not how you do it. That's the problem right there. You think that you can just issue commands to people and they're just going to follow you like you're leading an army or something. No, it doesn't work that way. You are serving these people. And you have to assess the situation and deal with it in a rational way. And that is not what happened here. They saw a 12-year-old kid with a gun. They did not know if it was real or fake. They assumed it was real. And when they commanded the kid to do something, he reached to his waist for the gun. Now, I would suspect that probably the kid thought he was supposed to give the gun to the cops. He's reaching for it to give it to them. I mean, yeah, it's not very smart when you're an adult. But when you're 12 years old, I could see that misunderstanding taking place. How many things did you get wrong when you were 12 years old? And just imagine, you know, having a couple of cops come up to you when you're 12 running around the playground, that's got to be kind of frightening in and of itself. So maybe you don't react exactly the way you're supposed to react. Maybe you do something you're not supposed to do, but you're only holding a toy. Fact is, these cops, or the cop that shot him, was not trained properly, as many do not seem to be. He acted in an hysterical manner. He killed somebody. Needs to be held accountable for this. And cops need to be pulled off the street and retrained so that when they face a situation like this, or like anything else, like the countless ones that we've talked about, whether it's the guy being smothered in Staten Island or the guy in Times Square walking backwards with a knife who was mowed down, there are other ways of dealing with situations like this where you don't have to take a life. And if you feel that you do, you shouldn't be a cop. If you get scared by situations like this, you shouldn't be a cop. It's a tough job. It's a risky job. But why? Why would we honor these people and call them heroes when they're better armed than anybody, they're protected, and they get to kill before they even have anything aimed at them? They killed this kid before he even took the toy gun out of his waistband. So that's the act of a hero? See, I think the act of a hero would be somebody who took a shot or was able to get out of the way of incoming bullets, real bullets, and then did what he had to do. Because he didn't jump the gun. He took a risk. He put his own safety on the line. Isn't that what a hero does? You see, if it's just somebody who shoots from the hip and asks questions later, well, there's a lot of heroes walking around. You know, and I'm sorry, but I think we've lost something along the way. I mentioned the NRA, and I just got to mention this as well, because this has been really bugging me. I'm waiting. I had a fun time on Twitter last night. Wow. It was incredible. Watching various Twitter feeds, watching various cable news channels and local news channels, listening to the police scanner through the internet of Ferguson, and basically just sending all kinds of updates back and forth. You realize the power of social media when it's used in this kind of a way. The whole world was watching. There was Ustream and Livestream and all kinds of things going on that you could basically experience live and see for yourself what was actually going on. And one of the things that I asked at the time was basically directed at the NRA. I said, you know, this is what you guys are talking about. This is this whole Second Amendment thing where people rise up against an oppressive regime. That's why you're seeing people small arms fire. That's what was going on in Ferguson's small arms fire. I was listening to the police scanner. They were pulling back because they were taking fire from east and west. I heard that at one point. And that's a horrible thing. That's a horrible thing. But that is the country that has been constructed by the NRA attitude that you got to arm people. First of all, you got to arm people to protect yourself against the people that are armed. But also, because the Second Amendment says so, it's so that the people have the power to take down the government, to take back their government. Well, here we are. Here we are. We have people that are oppressed, that are angry, that see no way out, and you're in a state where, hey, it's encouraged to carry a gun. And all of a sudden, everyone's firing guns everywhere. Where's the NRA saying, okay, guys, yeah, this is how you do it. Good for you. Not a word. Not a word. I have the feeling if they weren't black, maybe they'd be a little more forthcoming with the support. Bunch of black people running around the city armed. I think that kind of scares your typical NRA member. I don't know, just a theory. But still waiting to hear a comment from them on how all this works. I know that when you have demonstrations in New York, you have vocal demonstrations, you have a lot of passion and expression. In fact, last night, wow, it was pretty incredible. Marched all the way through the village to the West Village, up to Times Square, through Union Square at one point. That's where it started. And the cops could not stop them. You know, that whole thing about you have to have a permit to have a demonstration, to have a parade. No, you don't. When people get angry, you don't have to have that. That is the power of the people. And you saw that last night in New York. And not a single bullet was fired because we don't do that. And it's a whole lot more constructive. Okay, some of us do that, I know. But as a rule, as a general rule, it's considered a distraction at the least. This whole thing really was, like I said, not surprising, but so sad, so pathetic. When you think of what a grand jury is, I know a lot of people who have served on grand juries. I almost was on a grand jury once myself. Missed it by a hair. But every time I've talked to somebody who's been on a grand jury, they've pretty much done everything the prosecutor said. You know that phrase, you can indict a ham sandwich, is that? Yeah, that's what a grand jury does. They can indict anything the prosecutor says that this person probably committed these crimes, probably did this. Well, you're going to believe them. Because the way the grand jury works, you don't really have a whole lot of back and forth. The defense doesn't really get to present their case. However, in this particular case, they did. And it was very different. So, it was unusual what happened. I think something like one in, I'm looking for the actual numbers. Here we go. 162,000 federal cases in the year 2010. Now, this is not a federal case, obviously, but 162,000 federal cases prosecuted by U.S. attorneys. Of those, these are brought to grand juries, of those 162,000, how many do you think wound up not going to trial? Anyone? 11. No, not 11,000. No. 11. 11 out of 162,000 did not go to trial. So that's why this is kind of unusual when something like this happens. But it's not really when you think about it, because if you ever watch a cop show, any cop show, from The Wire to NYPD Blue, I'm sorry, The Wire is more than a cop show, I know, but if you watch any program, any movie, any read any book that has to do with the police justice system in this country, you realize these people know each other. They work in the same building. They pass each other in the hallway. They hang out in court. So it's very unusual for a prosecutor to prosecute a cop. It's not very likely to happen. If you look at the transcript of the grand jury proceedings, which have been made available and are all over the internet right now, you'll see that this was, at best, a half-hearted attempt. In fact, there's all kinds of reports of just a glut of information being thrown at the grand jury, which basically made it impossible for them to figure anything out, and lack of any real cross-examination. A lot of attention being brought to witnesses with conflicting stories. That happens. You can have witnesses see a sunrise and have conflicting bits of information. That is always going to happen. I heard on the radio over here, on the way over here before, that part of the reason why it was so hard to get an indictment was because one of the witnesses said Michael Brown was shot in the back, when in actuality he was not shot in the back. And they recanted that. You know, I could see somebody getting that wrong. Somebody watching from a window across the street or down the block and seeing a lot of motion and seeing somebody go down. Were they facing the other way when they went down? Were they facing, you know, people twist around and turn and things like that? It's entirely possible to get something like that wrong. But what you have to do is look at the number of people that are saying the same thing and balance that out. But keep in mind, you know, even though this was presented to the grand jury, this is not a trial. You see, we're used to cops getting away with things at trial, being found not guilty. But now we don't even get the trial. You see, that's I think, what's really frustrating here. It didn't even get to that point. The person who was filing charges, the district attorney, the prosecuting attorney, was basically not convinced himself. In fact, if you watched that press conference last night and followed some of the basic dialogue that was going on both in the media and on the net, a lot of people thought that was the defense attorney. He basically blamed social media for all of this in the first place and did such a good job defending Wilson that people were wondering, where is the prosecutor? All right. You know what? A couple other things I just wanted to get to. First of all, there are demonstrations all over the places. One about to start in Union Square. If you go to Ferguson Response, one word, FergusonResponse.tumblr.com, and as in the tradition of the internet, don't spell Tumblr right, TUMBLR.com, you'll see a really, really nicely laid out display of demonstrations all throughout the country. Some took place yesterday, some are taking place today. I imagine some are taking place in the future. Vast majority of them very peaceful and constructive and important. So I suggest checking those out no matter where you are. I hear a lot of people saying, what would Martin Luther King say to all this? You know, he was one of the good guys. He would be so upset at what you are doing, you know? And you hear quotes like this, all right? You hear people say ignorant things like, a riot is the language of the unheard. A riot is a language. What would Martin Luther King say to that? You know what he'd say? He'd say, how dare you use my words? Yes, Martin Luther King said that. Martin Luther King said, a riot is the language of the unheard. What has America failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the economic plight of the Negro, and that's back when that word was used, that's how little things have changed, that the language has changed faster than the actual social system that we have in this country. It has failed to hear that the economic plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years. This was an interview with Mike Wallace back in 1966. How many summers like this do you imagine that we can expect? Mike Wallace asks. I would say this, we don't have long. The mood of the Negro community now is one of urgency, one of saying that we aren't going to wait, that we've got to have our freedom. We've waited too long. So that I would say that every summer we're going to have this kind of vigorous protest. My hope is that it will be nonviolent. I would hope that we can avoid riots because riots are self-defeating and socially destructive. I would hope that we can avoid riots, but that we would be as militant and as determined next summer and throughout the winter as we have been this summer. And I think the answer about how long it will take will depend on the federal government, on the city halls of our various cities, and on white America to a large extent. This is where we are at this point, and I think white America will determine how long it will be and which way we go in the future. Now, Mike Wallace at this point asked Martin Luther King, even Senator Jacob Javits asked a question recently. He said that he was a slum resident. He and some of his fellow Jews were able to make it out of the ghetto on the Lower East Side of New York. The same thing is true with lots of Irish, Italians. He asked the question, why the Negro finds it difficult? Finds it so difficult to make his way up out of the ghetto. To which Martin Luther King said, number one, no other racial group has been a slave in America. It's nice to say other people were down and they got up. They were not slaves on American soil. The other thing is that the Negro had high visibility, and because of the prejudices existing in this country, his color has been against him. It's been against him, and they've used this to keep him from moving up in the final analysis. When you say to a man that you're in this position because of your race or because of your color, you say to that man that he can never get out of it. Other racial groups have been able to maybe change their accent, change their names. The Negro cannot. We look back in history. We see how little things have changed. We see how much things have changed. And there's so much more left to do. We're out of time. And I'm playing the Dumbass of the Week music again instead of the outro. I'm sorry. I guess I do get nominated this week. Let's just turn that down. We'll be back again next week, though, and hopefully we'll have more to talk about. We'll be able to take phone calls then. But you can write to us, otw@2600.com. And we'd like to hear your viewpoints, and we'll discuss that next week as well. Meantime, stay tuned for basketball here on WUSB. It's Emmanuel for Off the Wall. Have a good night.
Black Wolf, the legendary foundation. Sending this one out to the people. You know what I mean? My people's in the streets of Amsterdam, the streets of New York City. You know what I'm saying? In the streets of Jamaica to the ghettos of London. Word up. People's in the struggle in Paris, Cuba, South Africa. Word up. Worldwide. Roots crew. Yeah. Open your minds to this one. Feel it. Feel it so real.
This morning, I woke up in a curfew. Oh God, I was a prisoner too. Yeah, could not recognize the faces standing over me. They were all dressed in uniforms of brutality.
You are listening to 90.1 WUSB Stony Brook. The 2-2 Stony Brook Seawolves are about to take on the 1-2 Western Kentucky Hilltoppers. We're going to send to Kurt Hilton and Jeff Bernstein at the Island for the pregame show.
And from the Island Federal Credit Union Arena, welcome to Stony Brook Seawolves basketball, where tonight the Seawolves take on the Hilltoppers of Western Kentucky, one of the legendary programs in college basketball and coming out of Conference USA.